I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
That is correct. You listen to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Nardwar the Human Serviette will be being preempted today because we are doing a live broadcast on location at the Van City Theater of Cineworks in part of the Meet the Filmmakers panel in conjunction with the Vancouver Independent International Film Festival. Excuse me. This series of informal dialogues and insightful panels of filmmakers in conversation offers the unique chance to glimpse the creative process behind the screen and through the eyes of some contemporary cinema's most intriguing auteurs. Today's panel features Sarah McIntyre, director of the VIFF feature, Two Indians Talking, in conversation with director Scott Swan. We go to there live right now.
I really think this is an amazing metaphor for what the arts can do to bring two cultures together. That through the arts, there's a chance to really tell stories that need to be told on both sides. It's important that the native culture obviously hear their own stories mirrored back to them and understand what that's about. But also for us to be in the room and to hear those stories and to have another perspective on our lives as well is incredibly important. And we forget sometimes that it's really the arts that does that. It's not politics. It's the arts that bring us together in that way, and just to be part of that was really a wonderful experience. The other thing for me, as Sarah knows, is that I'm a real Shavian. I love George Bernard Shaw, and one of the great things about Shaw is he takes very, very, very difficult subjects like prostitution and slum landlordism and philandering, and turns them into pieces that have enormous comedy in them, but still really make their point. And that's what's so wonderful about the script, and about the way the actors handled the script, and also obviously in the way you encourage them to explore that comedy in themselves. And I thought that was wonderful, because if that doesn't work, the script and the piece and the film don't work either. And I thought that was really terrific. So when you were working with the script, when you first looked at those massive amounts of pages with all those words on them, what were your reactions and how did you manage to work through to that lovely convention that you found that's a standard film convention of the conversation continuing but the location changing? How did you work that?
Yes, that was the challenge. I think I just trusted that we would get there. Like, I could see it in my mind, and I could feel the story, and I knew that there was a way to tell this without dragging it, and I think I just put it in front of a lot of different people and asked for ideas and asked for suggestions. We didn't find the location until about 2 or 3 weeks before we were supposed to start shooting. So I actually didn't even know what kind of environment the story was going to take place in. If it was an apartment, if it was a community center, if it was something else, I just knew it was this confined space. And I guess at some point I thought, all right, we just have to cut this up. Like, it's just got to be done. Somebody has to do it. It's probably going to be me. So I just started looking at where the natural groupings of thought were, and started to draw lines on pages and try them out. So I guess it was still sort of a soft idea in my mind. And then when we got to set, I presented it to the two actors. They knew that we were going to have to do something with it, and I was encouraging them to give me suggestions too. So when we got to set and saw the space, and there was so much stuff in that room, like there was just so much junk, and we brought more junk in. And the idea was, it's just two guys who are alone together for 24 hours. What do? Well, you fiddle with things. You play pool and you play with the foosball table and you play video games. And so I was like, all right, show me what you would do. And with them, we decided where the cuts in the dialogue were going to be. So it actually happened pretty fluidly with a lot of conversation by the parties. And then at some point we just had to say, yep, this is what we're doing. And go with it.
And it really worked. I thought the phrasing that you found with that, those conversations was amazing. You know, that it was just effortless, and we all bought into it. There's just a moment of, oh yeah, this is the conversation that ended 15 minutes ago, mm-hmm. or now we're in another location, and the conversation continues. Mm-hmm. And it's lovely. We have that convention, that other variation of truth, yeah. And it was really effortless, which was wonderful.
And that's what I like about it, is that's what happens in real life, is you have a conversation that will span hours or days, you know, and you just, when you're with somebody in a space like that, you just pick it up. You don't need to keep referring to what happened. And they probably talked about other stuff in between the breaks too, but we don't need to know about it.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
So walk us through casting. How did that process go? What were you looking for? What were you playing with? What were the happy accidents that occurred?
Nathaniel Arcand was the first piece of the puzzle to be presented to me, and it happened that way. I had actually met him about a year beforehand, and when his name came up in relation to this script, I didn't think he was the right guy. I had met him under very different circumstances, and he presented with a lot of machismo, and he was sort of playing the movie star in the set that I had met him at, and I just thought, all right, I'll meet with him, you know, because it's already been set up, and I don't want to be rude, but I really didn't think he was the right person. And we just talked, and I sort of felt like I was pitching him on me, and he just wanted to shoot the breeze. So I realized that he was testing me a little bit, and I relaxed and just let him talk, and he started to tell me stories. He started to tell stories about what he connected with in this character and his own experiences as a Native actor and as a Native man, and what it's like to go between the two worlds, being on the reserve and being in the bigger city. And I think at one point I was describing the character to him, because I don't think he'd even read the script. He probably had skimmed through it, but I don't think he'd read the script. So I was describing the character to him, and all of a sudden he sort of got this faraway look in his eyes, and he drifted off a little bit. And I went, what happened? And he said, I think Andrew wrote this about me.
Hmm.
He said, I think Andrew wrote this about me. And I went, well, then you're the guy. We have to do this together. It was that easy. And I knew in that moment. So because he's got such a big reputation, having him as a part of the cast gave me a lot of credibility when I went to find the rest of my cast. And really, it was as easy as we had a table read. I wanted to hear the script out loud for my own purposes, and also to get feedback on how it flowed. I wanted actors to tell me how they felt with the material. So Carmen Moore, who had come on board as a producer, she organized a table reading for me. It was all Native actors. And Justin showed up, and he just acted his little heart out at the table reading, which blew me away. And I said to him afterwards, I really want to see you in the audition room, and gave him a couple of notes. There were some things that I wanted him to work on, and he took it very seriously and said, I really want to audition for you. I'm quite serious about this role. So months later, we had our audition sessions, and he came along with a bunch of other people. The Aboriginal talent community is quite small in the Lower Mainland, and I think there are a lot of actors who have built careers on just being Native, and they show up and they look good on horses, or they look good in buckskin, and I know that sounds crass, but I think
that's absolutely. What
happens. But not a lot of them have really been trained properly as actors. So we saw some lovely people, but there was an even smaller percentage that really had acting chops. Justin was definitely one of them, but he was very green. So went through the audition process, and then I was offered the opportunity to meet another actor for that role, the role of Adam, an actor who has the same stature as Nathaniel. He's a star. So we met, and I could imagine the two of them playing the characters together, and I just thought, I have to do this. Like, it would be silly not to have two names in the film. Mm-hmm. It would be good for the film. It would be good for me. So we moved forward. And what I did is I called Justin, and I told him what had happened. I said, I really appreciate all the preparation that you've put in. I can see what you're doing. I really like your work. But I've been given the opportunity to work with a name, and I have to go with it. And he said, oh, you have to go with it. Like, he got it. He really got it, which was beautiful of him. So then, months later, 3 weeks before we were supposed to get a camera, that other actor had to pull out. His wife was about to have a baby, and he couldn't get time off work. And his agent just said to me, I'm sorry, but he's going to have to pull out. So I called Justin and said, I need a pinch hitter. And luckily, I had established a connection with him and was able to just speak to him honestly. And he said, yes, of course. He said, I don't even have to answer that. I'm there for you.
That's great.
So he's my knight. He's the one who really came through. And the other four characters I met through the audition process, the girls made themselves very clear to me. It was really easy to choose. I mean, I was so familiar with the characters by that point. I'd spent about a year with the script. I knew them. I knew them inside and out. I knew the energy that I was looking for. I knew what the relationships had to be like. I knew the textures that it needed to be. And so when they walked in the room, and, you know, within a few seconds of people speaking, I just knew yes or no, that was it. So, yeah, it really felt like I was gifted with a lot of opportunities. The right people came forward.
Well, that makes sense. I also think that, you know, there's a place where when a director extends back to an actor and makes that phone call and says, I really loved your work, but I have to do this for the movie, you know, I have to make this happen, that's rare. That's a very rare thing. You know, as an actor and a director in his business, you wind up with just dead air at the end of the phone call so many times. You never hear how the audition went. You never hear what went on. Yeah. And to have, which I know you have because I know you, the heart to do that and the humanity to do that, I think, is why he would respond the way he would. Yeah. You know, and we miss that sometimes in this business. We're supposed to be telling very deeply human stories, and we don't treat our actors many times like they're human beings. Yeah. We don't respect them in a lot of ways. And just even that phone call is a very, very powerful thing to do. I have a good friend who is a fellow who worked in advertising for years and was working on a commercial one day and said to the DOP, we should get the talent in the room. And the DOP said, well, you can get the actors in the room if you want to, but the talent's already in the room.
Ouch.
So there's a place where, you know, we know we're 11% of the budget, you know, we get that. But to have that, just that very simple, I care about you as a human being and please understand this. And for him to say, first of all, you got to do this, shows his heart.
Yeah.
And then for him to step up and say, absolutely, I want to do this later on. And I think that's what brings that kind of chemistry together on a set that you obviously had. So that was wonderful.
Yeah, I was proud of that. We actually ended up spending the afternoon together. I offered to, you know, meet him for coffee and explain what was going on. And we ended up just walking all around the seawall, I think. And so I learned a lot about him, which means I had spent more time with him and got a sense of where he was at and what he was like, so that when I picked up the phone, I knew that he was exactly the right person to step in. Yeah.
Yeah, I read an article in the paper a while ago about film festivals, about what was happening in film festivals these days as opposed to what was happening 10 years ago. And I'd just like to get your response to this. I know you're in the next phase now. You're looking at how this is going to move forward and where it might go. And the article talked about the fact that film festivals used to be this wonderful sort of conduit for new films to arrive in the community and be picked up and distributed in major cinemas across Canada or wherever, and that didn't seem to be happening anymore, that now there seemed to be an arts circuit, and that was kind of it at this point. And we'd lost that bridge between the two. Do you have a sense of that? I mean, I know you're not there yet, but do you have a sense of that disconnect between the arts in the major theaters across the country and the festivals themselves?
Yeah, that feels true to me. And I think because distribution is such a tough game right now, there's so many films being made because it's so accessible. The technology is easy to get your hands on. There are so many films being made, and distribution is shifting and changing form, and we're still not quite certain where it's going to land. I've been hearing a conversation about using the festival circuit as your theatrical release, which is kind of how I've been thinking about this project, is we'll get it into festivals and that will be where it's seen on big screens in the theaters, and then we'll go for television and internet and, you know, smaller community screenings and stuff. So it makes sense. It still makes sense. And I think there are certain festivals that are known as buyer's markets. Mm-hmm. I mean, Toronto's seen that way. Cannes is seen that way. Berlin is seen that way. People, distributors go to the festivals to buy films for theatrical distribution and, you know, and for broadcast. But again, their budgets are getting smaller and smaller, and screen space is getting smaller. And it seems to me that more mainstream films are being shown at theaters as a way to tease the audience, like as a way to get buzz going ahead of time, so that when they get widescreen distribution, there's already sort of information about them out there because they've been at festivals. So that seems to be taking up screens as well that used to be for smaller projects.
Yeah. It's going to be an interesting journey, I think, to see how the film translates and moves forward at this point. Yeah. And it's so extraordinary in this business that you wind up being a director and then having to move forward and really market the film in a whole other way. It's a huge journey. I know you said you just finished it about 3 weeks ago, and now you've given birth, and now there's this huge development and moving it forward in some way. It's a 4-year probably commitment to it as you move through it, which is amazing.
Yeah, and I was realizing the learning curve for me. Overall, the journey has been lovely, really very civilized. You know, there have been long stretches of time where nothing was happening, and if I didn't get too frustrated about that, it was quite nice to have breaths in between chunks of work. But you know, there have been times where I've sort of been frustrated and tired and all that kind of stuff, and I realized I've learned how to produce my first feature at the same time that I've learned how to direct my first feature. Like, those two things have been going on at the same time, and I think that's what we do. You know, if you're the director, if it's your project, you have to pull it forward because nobody else is going to. So it's tough, man.
Huge. Yeah, I was going to ask, what's the largest lesson you've learned out of the project to this point?
That could go a bunch of different ways. So from the whole director-producer conversation, they are two very different job lists. And so what I've learned is I really want to find a producer that I can partner with who will support me. And I think as a director who has done the producing work, I'd be a good partner for someone who wants to go there. Being on set, I've had about 4 or 5 people who are wearing producer hats right now, and they've kind of come in at different points of the game and, you know, helped carry the ball along. So I haven't been doing it all on my own, absolutely. There was a point leading up to the shooting where I just had to step away from producing. I mean, I was organizing and I was being part of scheduling and I was looking after the budget, but I had to just step away or it wasn't going to happen. I had to be with the story. I had to be with the actors. I had to just get on the other side of my brain. So that was a big aha. That's good to know. Like, I have to be able to turn that off. And it would be really nice to be a director all the way through, to only have to worry about the creative stuff. That would be really fun. I don't know if that happens in this country, but that would be really fun. So that was good. It was good to know that I had to just, you know, flick it off and that I could go there. But then as a director on set, you also have to be aware of the creative, emotional, and the logistical. Like, there's the crew and there are the actors. And the relationship that I had with my DOP was that I really just handed over the technical to him. Like, I let him direct the crew. He was wonderful. So I understood what director of photography means. He was directing the photography, and we would come together and plan the shots and, you know, map out what we were going to do. And then I just got out of the way and let him organize all that stuff. But still, it was me who was looking at the monitors going, I don't know what's in focus here, and, you know, like, this is not working for me. We're missing what, you know, what the action is or whatever. We had 2 cameras going the whole time, by the way, so there were 2 monitors to watch, and what I was doing was noticing where my eye was going between them to get a sense of if we had enough coverage, like, once we got to editing, to see if we had enough coverage. So I did still have to be in my logistical brain watching the camera work, and then being totally connected to the performers, which is like, I was feeling them and I was staying connected to them to make sure that they were okay, and really being in a visceral place, like, you know, responding to the intuition that was coming up. So again, it's a big job. Like, even just directing is a really big job.
I think it's one of the things that you bring to this, which is amazing, is just that understanding, love, and appreciation for actors. Yeah. You obviously created a really safe, a really vital set for them to work on, where they felt that they were owning their work and able to explore mm-hmm. and be together and take the time that they needed to do their work together. You know, and the chemistry that moved back and forward between them doesn't come without there being a place around them to feel safe and comfortable. So I thought that was really remarkable in the work. And also I felt that the directing was really transparent. There wasn't a moment of look at this or look at that, and isn't this brilliant, isn't this wonderful, and isn't, you know, it was very much in the background, very strong, very clear, very well coordinated, but really egoless in a beautiful way, a real sense of letting the story sort of tell itself and standing out of the way of the piece. And I think that's really remarkable. I think that to see that confidence in your ability as a director to let the actors do their work, to trust what the cameraman was doing, is unbelievably mature and wonderful to see. So many times you see directors and there's a moment where, as an audience member, you think, oh, that was really well directed. What an interesting shot. And suddenly you're out of the film commenting on the work itself. And I found that I was absolutely drawn into the relationship between these people and just allowed it to wash over me as it went through. And I think that requires a wonderful steady hand as a director, but a real capacity to back off and trust that they can do their work, and that egolessness in the work is so vital. I know you, and I have a strong sense
that's true.
That's who you are, you know? So when did you find that egolessness challenged? When did you feel you had to step in and do something?
Well, there was a lot going on between the actors off camera. There was really interesting chemistry going on between them. They worked from very different places. They work from really different places as performers, and so I was learning them as we were going, and then I was just making sure that they were staying okay with each other. So that kind of kept me busy.
Yeah.
That kept me busy, and then. I did trust them. I knew that they were good performers. I knew that they knew this material better than I ever could because they had lived it. I knew that my camera operators would catch it, and if they didn't, we could go again. And I knew that the script was so strong that really all we had to do was follow the dots. Like, that writing is so good. It was, you know, I still get teared up by just following that story, and it was all on the page. So really, really my only job was to just keep them in the moment, keep pushing their heads underwater, you know, like, stay there, go there, find tricks to help them with the amount of text if they got nervous about it. And that occupied all of my faculties, so there was no room really to have anything else going on.
They had a wonderful sense, I thought, of very simple, naturalistic dialogue. There was a lovely sense of silence between them and things moving in those silences, you know, that were really rich and really deep.
Yeah.
And again, that requires trust in each other and trust in what you're doing and in the story itself.
Yeah.
And I thought that was remarkable. Why did you choose to go with two cameras? What was the influence behind that?
I think it was really just economical in terms of time and energy. I was very concerned about wearing the actors out. And I've been on film sets that go 15, 20, 30 shots, and I knew that we just didn't have enough days to do that. I thought the performances would suffer and I would get bored. Like, I didn't want to do it. So it really was just economy. It was a really good idea.
I think so, too.
It was a really good idea. We were on set for 9 days. We were shooting for 9 days. So to get through, like, 30 pages a day is a huge task. I didn't really know how big a deal that was. I just I knew we had to do it. So there was no option, really. There was no argument. But, yeah, it was a really good idea. And I was watching the actors very carefully to make sure that they weren't getting burnout. And I sort of found the pace at which they were comfortable working and made sure that we stuck to that pace.
It was great. Yeah. I mean, just that, there's a lovely sense of them just allowing it to develop through them and not pushing and not forcing. So even though you're dealing with long days and you've got a lot of text to cover in that time, that you never felt like they were forcing their way through it to get through because of time restraints. There was a lovely relaxation and openness and ease about the performances that was really lovely. And mm-hmm. particularly, was the whole thing 9 days or how long? What was your shoot frame?
It was 9 days.
Wow.
We only had Nathaniel for 10 days because he works on Heartland that mm-hmm. shoots in Edmonton. He's got a regular role on the CBC series. So I only had him for 10 days, which means I had no rehearsal time with him whatsoever. Like, he walked on set on day one, which was rehearsal day. That was the only time, that was the first time that we were in the location. All the actors were together. We did a table read to start the morning. The crew was there. They saw the location for the first time. So we were set decking and we were blocking and the actors were getting to know each other. It was really fun. And then the next day we started rolling. Like, it just, and we had to end on time because he got on a plane the next day and flew out. So the funny thing is, because he'd been working all the way up to that time, I called him the night before just to connect and, mm-hmm. you know, see how he was doing and say there's going to be somebody to pick you up at the airport tomorrow morning. And he said, so there's a lot of lines in this, hey? No. He hadn't even read the script, really. I mean, I think he'd skimmed through it a couple times, but he just wasn't absorbing it because he was so occupied with what was going on. So we had no choice but to make it work.
Wow. That's amazing to be able to accomplish that in that length of time.
Yeah.
Is phenomenal. I mean, 9 days worth of shooting and to get 90 minutes, is that what it's running?
Or,
that's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Wow. I was fascinated that the first comment at the after the screening was this a stage play first?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's so dialogue heavy and so actor dependent.
Mm-hmm.
It's obvious that there's that feeling to it. I know when we talked about it originally, we both sort of said this would make a wonderful stage play mm-hmm. and could work really well. How did you work with translating that visually? Did you have a set of images? I mean, the first image that comes up is no exit.
Yeah.
Right? That's the first thing that appears on the screen is no exit.
Yeah.
And did that serve as a sort of central focus for you, or were you using that ironically, or what were you doing visually to help tell this amazing story?
That opening shot we found. I mean, it the no exit sign was just there in front of the trailer and in front of the other, whatever it is, the two trailers, and I saw it and went, yeah, that's pretty funny.
Yeah.
We have to use that. The blocking of it and the staging of it was really inspired by the environment. Like, I didn't know exactly what the shots were going to be before we got there. But once we walked into the environment, and I mean, I had seen it a couple weeks beforehand, obviously, when we made the agreement to shoot there. I just sort of walked around and went, I can see it happening here.
Great.
And then decided that I was going to let the actors show me where they wanted to be in the room. And so we blocked it the way that you would a stage play, that the performers really showed me. And, you know, of course I said to them, well, we've been in this corner for three chunks now. We had, like, let's move. Let's see what we can do with the foosball table. So we really let the environment inspire us, which I felt safe doing because it was a community center on a reserve. Like, nothing was faked. You can't get any more realistic than that. So I was like, okay, here we are. Here's where the story would actually take place. Let's see what we're going to do.
So no storyboarding, just creating it as you go along.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's really risky.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. I think because there's this place where if you allow the universe or the gods or whatever you want to help you tell the story, they step in and help you tell the story.
Yeah.
And if you have it all, you know, lined up in little nice little pieces on the storyboard,
it would have been ridiculous.
There's no room for that. There's no opportunity for those magnificent happy accidents that occur and bless you with them, like the no exit sign, or, you know, with Robert Altman and the American sign in Nashville, the huge airplane going by with American written on the side of it.
Yeah.
You can't buy those moments, and you can't plan for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that a lot of what you were doing as a director was reacting to what was occurring, allowing yourself to take it in and work with it rather than imposing your will upon it. Yeah. Can you talk a bit about
that? You know, and that whole theme became necessary because it's not my story. Like, it's just not my story to tell. So what I needed was to be shown where this story would take place.
Yeah, I absolutely hear that. I also think there are lots of other directors out there, whether they're female or white or whatever, would say, I know this story, I can tell it, and not have that ability to step back and allow it to be told to you and through you in that situation. And I think that's what really works, you know, is that there's a feeling that we're seeing this from a perspective that we haven't seen before. I mean, this amazing metaphor of bringing the two cultures together in the film itself and in the audience watching it. You know, I mean, that's really remarkable to see that, and that the art brings us together that way. And it doesn't happen unless you allow that to be told to you. Yeah. And I think as a director, to have the confidence to allow it to work upon you rather than investing your will within it is a magnificent thing to do. What was your budget, please?
Oh, 50, 60, probably cash so far is about $80,000.
Wow.
Yeah, 50 of that came from Telefilm. They came on board after we had shot. When I took them a fine cut, and they came in through their alternative distribution fund, which was amazing. It wouldn't have happened without that. And then about $30,000 was loan and some fundraising that happened. Less than $100,000 cash, but I've added up all the labor hours and volunteer equipment and stuff, and it was closer to about $400,000. So the value of the film is much, much, much higher than the actual money that we had to make it on, which is really cool.
And the value of the film is far higher than whatever dollars you spent, too, just because of what that story is and what is actually up there in on the screen. I mean, that's what's so remarkable.
Yeah.
What would you change? What would you do differently?
Oh, God.
Got a day?
Yes. I'd have experienced focus pullers. our crew was mostly recent graduates. The director of photography, Les Erskine, is a man who's got a long history in the film industry, so I really trusted him. He knows what he's doing. Again, we didn't have a lot of rehearsal time together, so we just talked about what the story was and what the approach was that I wanted to take, and then I let him do his thing. But he was really acting as a teacher on set. He was taking all of these kids who'd come right out of film school. Some of them had graduated weeks before. And what I learned is a lot of schools are not teaching lenses, because a lot of the cameras out there are digital. They're not learning how to operate lenses. So we were shooting with two HD cameras, digital cameras, but they had 35 millimeter lenses on them. So a lot of it's out of focus. Like, a lot of it's out of focus. It just is. So I would change that.
How many of you saw that? Okay, a couple of people.
Photographer.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But I mean, I was watching pretty closely, and I didn't, the moments that were like that didn't bother me.
Yeah.
That wasn't important to me. The story was important to me. The relationships were important to me. That's what I cared about. And I come at this from a theatrical point of view, I guess.
Yeah.
But when the tail starts wagging the dog and the technical side of things starts overriding the story, I think we have a problem in that situation. So it didn't bother me that there was a moment where the camera would move, or there was a sound pulse or whatever. That's not the most important thing to me,
okay,
you know, in that situation. Sarah said for the first time today she saw there was a boom in it. Anybody see the boom? Yeah, well, you know, as a director in the theater, you do that too. After you've seen it for 10 times, you think, oh no, not that. Oh, that moment's totally wrong. But you know, we don't see that because it's going by us the first time, and because we're so invested in telling that story and experiencing it with you.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. I do get caught up in the story still, and the stuff slides by.
And I hope that where it goes from here, people recognize the value of that and don't insist on the perfection of the technical side in order to distribute it. I mean, let's tell the story. Let's not worry about the room that it's set in. You know, I think that the story that's being told is what needs to be brought forward. And how wonderful that the film turned out to be a learning experience for some younger
yeah.
people as well.
Yeah, it was
That's
fun
another
to do it
level
that way.
Of moving people forward. I mean, the CBC used to do that on Beachcombers all the time.
Really?
You know, they would hire us to write an episode, and we couldn't put five words together to start with. And they'd say, well, give us a rough draft, and they'd actually slip you a little money for that. And then you'd go to the second level, and they were nurturing you. Phil Keatley and all those people on whose shoulders we stand on in this community, they were developing young writers and actors and directors through what they were producing. And I think that's wonderful. I think that's a great thing to be doing, rather than only sticking with the elite and the what's perfectly formed.
Yeah.
So what's there in the film is not only the stories that are being told, but the learning that's taking place as well. And there's a lot of learning going on in that piece in all kinds of different ways.
Yeah.
What else would you change?
There are some acting moments that I feel I missed. One conversation in particular is the Jane Austen conversation that happens in the kitchen in the middle of the night. And it was really just a matter of, I'll just name names. it was one of the parts of the script that Nathaniel was least prepared on, and because it does reference something that, you know, is outside of the world that we had been living in, it was just a piece of text that wasn't prepared. So, and he was tired, you know, we'd had a late night the night before, and he was tired and distracted. And so there was that going on with my performer. Justin's the kind of actor who knows his lines and everybody else's inside out and backwards. Like, and he would get really frustrated that everybody else wasn't on book. So we were managing that a little bit. So I really didn't have to worry about him in terms of text. But that was a tough piece of dialogue. Like, it, you know, if it's about a book that you haven't read and you have to act as if you know intimately what this story is about, it's a tough thing to pull off. So I feel like I missed it. I missed some of those moments. And we really had to piece together the performances. The other part of the challenge was the kitchen was incredibly small and I couldn't be in there with them. So I think what was happening is, in other parts of the script where the text was not as solid, I was able to be in, you know, I would go and be with them as soon as the camera stopped, and I just couldn't. I was in the other room watching the monitors, so I feel a little bit frustrated about that. There are Nathaniel's story about the little boy who lost his underwear in the pool. I would have crafted that a little bit more. And again, it was a matter of just a huge chunk of text that was going and going and going. So many stories within that long passage to learn. And so my focus was on helping him get through the text. And we could have gone a lot deeper with telling the, you know, just put more arcs in that story.
Yeah, it had a lovely simplicity, though. I mean, it really was. It had a lovely straightforwardness at that moment in the story where I thought worked really well, too, from an actor's point of view. We get, you know, sometimes as directors, we get to a place where we're tinkering with everything and we forget the fact that of the engagement that's taking place at that moment. And we see it perhaps differently as audience members than we do as directors at that moment.
Yeah.
So, that's not a huge thing.
Yeah.
Do you mind if we swing this out a little bit?
No,
I'd
love to.
Any questions or comments you'd like to make about what you saw or the process itself? Okay, next.
Hi.
Yes.
Of course
we can.
Turn to yours.
Thank you,
Jenny.
I don't think your PA is working.
It's actually a live broadcast.
It's being recorded.
Well, I had missed the early part of this, but this is coming from maybe a some snobbish American perspective, but it struck me odd that a young native Canadian would be that interested in Nietzsche as against Mark Twain or some other writer. I mean, it sounds a bit... I didn't catch the background of the student or the other character who was that interested in Nietzsche. I mean, is this unusual for... Canadian or American college kids from native backgrounds to be interested in European literature and that kind of philosophy? Or is it everybody gets this in college these days?
So the question was about how realistic is it that Adam's character as a young native man would be interested in Nietzsche, European literature? I don't know. He went to university. He didn't go to a native university. He just went to university. Like, he probably did. We decided that he probably did an arts degree at UBC, and would have been exposed to all kinds of things. So we just decided that it was realistic. I think he's... What I like about his character is I think he's like a lot of young kids who come out of university that are just spewing stuff that they have no personal relationship with yet. You know, he's sort of full of himself, and he's a little feeling confident and a little cheeky, and he's just sort of showing off a little bit. So sure, why would he not have read Nietzsche? Everybody else in class would have been, absolutely. He also knew about Jane Austen and Shakespeare and... Yeah.
Or any place talking about any ideas. It's always sports and rock music.
Well,
it was a bit improbable, but it was carried off well.
Okay.
As a literature student, yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I think Sarah's right, that there's a feeling of him feeling insecure around the other fellow. Mm-hmm. So there's a chance to show off what I know, because mm-hmm. he doesn't know how to fish. Mm-hmm. So there's a place of having to show off what he does know. And he's reaching for the things that he understands vaguely or has his fingernails around in some way, wants to use them to feel secure and to impress the other person. And it's a wonderful reach, and it's beautifully funny at the same time. It's got this lovely sense of humor about it, which I think is terrific. I like that a lot. Other?
Well, the screenwriter is an Aboriginal man, and he clearly, the screenwriter is an Aboriginal man, and he's read Nietzsche, I guess, because he's stuck it in there. Yeah. And he said that most of the conversations that happen within the script are real conversations that he's witnessed or had with his own friends and family and peers. So, why not? And in the story, it turns out that she's also read Nietzsche. They're sort of, you know, having a
Nietzsche contest.
A sparring contest, with each other to see who can come up with the most obscure quotes.
Exactly.
I haven't read Nietzsche, but I think it's hilarious that they do.
Me too.
That's all you need to
know. Okay.
Hang on till we get your mic.
There's Jenny over here.
Sure.
That bring... It also felt to me that somehow that Nietzsche passage really meant something to him. Like for some reason he connected to it. It wasn't just garble to him, that it really did connect to him. And that's why he knew it.
Yeah, the particular quotes that he shares are actually quite poignant and directly related to the situation that they're in. So I can see him going and looking for, you know, support and inspiration in any place that he could find it. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a young man involved in remembering his life, you know? I mean, there's that comment about, well, anybody can learn what's put in front of you.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, maybe. And if you learn it the way most educational institutions teach you, you learn it and you pass the exam and then you forget it, right? But he's a man involved in incorporating what he bumps into in the world into himself and to find out a relationship with that between himself, the material, and the world. And I think that's fascinating, that's a real sense of remembering what he's come across and finding a way to make sense of it and use it in the world, which is terrific. And that's a very powerful place to come from, I think. And I think it's used well that way.
Yeah.
That brings me to a question that I had when I was watching the film, which was how you would envision that the film would engage with young Aboriginal communities in BC. Would that be through television or like through screenings such as this? Or I was sort of curious about the element of like for young people who are native watching the film, where would this?
So do you mean how will it get to them?
Yeah.
How will they see it? Mm-hmm. Well, I would love to have it broadcast on television. Absolutely. That's part of the next chunk of work is to go and try and make those sales. I would love to have community screenings of it. My biggest fantasy, actually, is to go into community centers and bring people together and show the film and then hang out and talk about it afterwards. And what I've seen so far is that there's so little material for that audience that there's a huge hunger for it, and it's striking a chord with all kinds of, you know, age groups and backgrounds. I've sort of been thinking of it as a film that I'm interested, you know, someone of my age group and lifestyle. But I've had some really fun circumstances where different groups of people who've been working on the film have really resonated. Like, there have been three classes of audio students at the Art Institute, which is a media arts college, who helped with the dialogue cleanup. So young guys, none of them native, and they were enthralled with it. Like, you know, between 18 and 20-year-old white kids and Asian kids who, even after working on the film for 3 months, were sitting and watching the work and laughing and, you know, elbowing each other. They were completely captivated, which I did not predict at all. So it feels to me like absolutely it's for those communities who don't get to see themselves a lot. I think it's striking home. So you're back to your question. You know, I would love to have it on television. I would love to just take it and hand it to people in those centers and get them to gather around. But I think it also, because the conversations and the struggles are quite universal, it's not specific to that culture. It doesn't have to be specific to that culture. There's a lot that I resonate with. There's a lot that other people resonate with. I think it can go into other places too and have a life.
I think that's really important, that any story that's told, the more specific the story is,
yeah,
in its location and in the imagery with which those stories are related,
yeah,
it makes it more universal. Of course, this is a story about Native communities, but if you want to look at a reservation, go into an office sometime and see people sitting behind cubicles for 8 hours a day. There are lots of places that people can relate to, mm-hmm, not being able to express themselves fully, or how they can get out of where they're trapped and move forward.
Mm-hmm.
Of course the res is one, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But if we pigeonhole this film as a film about Aboriginal conditions, we underestimate what it's about. Mm. It's about so many other things in the world that we deal with too. And because it's so specific and so rooted in Aboriginal stories and interplay, it resonates with us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's terrific.
Mm-hmm.
So of course it should go to all of the communities and people should see it that way. But there's a huge audience for this film, mm, in terms of how it resonates with us as individuals trying to get away from those things that entrap us. I did some work with multiculturalism and racism a while ago, harvesting stories of racism with the Native community on the island. And one wonderful woman was there, and she said, I was 14 years old, I lived in Terrace, I was at a rodeo, and there were some white guys across the street, and they were calling these incredible names at me. Like, they were obviously yelling these strong epithets, which I can't say right now. And she said she turned to look to see who they were talking to, because it wasn't her, obviously. She wasn't anybody like that. And she said, there was nobody there, so she said, well, I guess they must have seen me that way. Hmm. And then she realized 5 years later that she had internalized all that they had said to her. And she now was that person. And she lived her life that way for a number of years. And then she was on a spirit quest one day with a group of her friends on the island. And she suddenly said, I had this moment where I realized that wasn't my story. That the story I was waking up with every morning and thinking I was cast in that role as the victim, as this particular person who was a prostitute, I didn't have to be anymore. I could change that. And she said, I changed like that. And now she's counseling other people and working with the Native community to shift it. And that's how story can change us, whether it's an internal story that we hear ourselves or whether it's a story that we see on film or television or,
yeah,
on stage. That's how things can shift dramatically.
Yeah.
And I think that's remarkable. That's what's going on here in this piece, is of course it's rooted in that community, but more importantly, it's rooted in us,
yeah,
and what we're working with too.
Yeah.
So I can see why it obviously resonates with you in that situation.
Yeah. I'm just insatiably curious. Like, I'm snoopy. I want to know what people are talking about. I want to know how they live. I want to know what kinds of, you know, what are you doing all day? Like, and this to me feels like, so from a selfish place, this is a culture that I'm surrounded by. Clearly, it's a big part of where I live, but I don't have access to it. So this story was a way just to get in the room with those guys and hear what they were talking about and find out what people are thinking. That's what I get out of it. So I can see that a non-native audience would be attracted for that reason too. Like, you know, what's up with,
yeah,
what's going on,
yeah,
behind those doors? Why are we in this situation? Why is it so scary to ask those questions? Why can't I say, yeah, but that, you know? So So yeah. That's where I'm coming from.
Other questions?
Going back to what you're talking about, the audiences that this can resonate with, originally when I saw through the screener that you had applied to VIF, it was discussing Mr. Darcy.
Right.
And then it changed over to Two Indians Talking.
Yeah.
Do you think the title change will affect the target audience, essentially? Because when I picked it up and saw Discussing Mr. Darcy, I had no idea what it was about. And I was like, this is really interesting. But like you were saying, it's like it gets you into the room. It allows you to look at something that we rarely will ever get a chance to be exposed to because we're not on Squamish land. It's like, well, we are on Squamish land, but we're not on the reserve. So it's like we don't get a chance to see that as much. And this gives us a little insight. So it's like I just wanted to know how you felt about the title and what were some of the reasons you did for changing it.
You know, Two Indians Talking is actually the title of the script. Andrew gave it that title. And I liked it. I thought it was funny. But in the year that I was developing the script, before we started shooting, I was kind of showing it to different people and getting response. And some people loved it and some people hated it. And some people thought it might be too inflammatory. And so I just was telling everybody, you know, I'm open to ideas. I don't know if we're going to stay with it, but what do you think? And at some point, I just decided to change it. And Discussing Mr. Darcy was the title that we came up with because it's catchy and it's a literary reference. And I thought that, you know, actually the idea for that was that I didn't want it to be pigeonholed as a First Nations movie. Like, I didn't want it to be categorized that way and demeaned in any way. And I thought, I want this to have access to as big an audience as possible. How can I open the doors a little? So having a Jane Austen reference would attract film festival goers who would get it. You know, they would be the kinds of people who would resonate with that. So I hung out with that title for a while. But then I realized that the Jane Austen conversation in the film is not a big enough payoff to have that be the title of the film. Like, it was just... It was not worth it to go there, and it also just wasn't as catchy, it wasn't as memorable. I was sort of, a couple of people said to me, you know, if you're flipping through a catalog of films to go see at the festival, it doesn't really jump off the page at you, whereas Two Indians Talking is a little provocative, and it probably would stay in your mind more, so I decided to go back with it. And it's funny because on the Facebook group, when I changed the name back, a couple people said, oh, like, you know, why are you calling it that? That's a little derogatory, isn't it? And some people were like, thank God you got rid of Discussing Mr. Darcy because this is way better. So, again, you know, Andrew is such a wonderful writer. I just decided to trust his decision and stick with what was easy.
You know, if you'd gone through the focus group process, he would have come up with a wonderful title, which would have been Two Indians Talking About Jane Austen.
Probably. Which, you know,
four people would have come to see.
I know. Yeah, that's it.
Any other questions?
A more personal question. Can I just ask you how you learned to be a producer, specifically?
How I learned to be a producer?
Yeah. Was it like you wanted to be a director and then you were forced by the necessity of things to be a producer too because you trusted yourself more than a partner in producing your movie? Or was it like you learned to be a producer and also you had this great idea of making a movie and as a director and then you thought, in which order did the
what's the priority
producer and director
producing
come
directing out? Okay. I've done a lot of things within the film community in Vancouver. I trained as an actor. Cheryl Matheson was actually my instructor at Douglas College. So, wow, you were Cheryl Matheson when you were teaching me. She's now Cheryl Swan, related to Scott Swan. Sorry. So I trained as an actor, and then I decided that it would probably be a good idea to learn more about what happened on the other side of the camera. So I just started helping out on other people's films and did a little bit of producing. I also got involved in casting. I spent a number of years as a casting assistant and then a casting director. And that was an opportunity to watch directors and actors in the room together and see how that works, you know, what the dynamic is. Good directing and bad directing, or effective directing and not effective directing. I also spent a number of years co-producing a script reading series. So for about 4 years, I was reading scripts and watching scripts be workshopped in front of an audience. Huge education in story and not being attached to your material and all that kind of stuff. And what I was doing the whole time was I was trying to figure out where I belonged. Like, I knew that it was the right community to be in, but I didn't know what chair I was supposed to be sitting in. So producing was in there. There's so much independent film going on in Vancouver that it's really easy to just pitch in and help out and take on producing responsibilities. And spent a lot of time working within the women in film community as well, teaching and coaching and learning and all that kind of stuff. So when I realized that actually directing was what it all added up to a number of years ago, I felt like I sort of had to start over again and learn to be a director after having studied all of those other parts of the process. So my relationship with this story was I knew I wanted to direct it. I had finally realized, yes, I want to direct. I'm ready to do a feature film. This is the baby that it's going to happen with. But just because of the way things happen, I think anywhere, I'm not going to call it a Canadian problem, you have to start producing your own material. So I put out the call for help for producing help, and other people definitely came on and shared the workload with me. But again, it was my money and my heart on the line. You know, I was the one who had to keep moving the ball forward. So I did take a lot of the responsibility for producing. I don't want to be known as a producer. I would rather get known as a director. But I think as a producer, as a director who knows how to produce, I'm a more valuable asset than somebody who's only focusing on directing. Does that get to the heart of it? That's a long answer.
Hi. You sound like the kind of person who would also make really good documentaries. Because I'm interested in this, that you're not using a storyboard and that you're really kind of just working with what you have and feeling your way through the story and get the best out of it. And like you said, I mean, it's not so important how it works technically, but that we get something out of it and you get moved by the film, because that's what we want, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering, have you done documentaries? Or because there's a fiction film called Welcome. It's about immigrants coming to France, I think. Mm. And in that case, that was the film, and I thought, oh my God, fiction is actually so much better than a documentary in that case. So there can be cases when, it's an interesting kind of intersection, which one to go for getting certain stories across.
Before we got to set and I let things happen, I spent a year with the script. So I sure didn't wing this. Like, I really relied on that script. And that was one of the things that I learned from Scott. I took a directing course with him, was how to prepare with the script before the actors ever show up. So, and again, I think because I spent so many years working with writers and watching scripts be workshopped and watching story be crafted, I actually feel really attached to having a script as the backbone of a project. But I really think it depends on the story. Like, I think certain stories can only be told by documentary filmmaking. You know, you just have to go and tell a story that's happening in front of you, and that's absolutely appropriate. I don't feel compelled to go there myself, just because I am so reliant on script. I've actually also been involved in a couple projects that were documentary projects, and I was brought in to go and find the story. Like, people who'd been shooting for months and months and months and had hours of footage, and they lost track of what the story was. And in one particular circumstance, I was brought in to look at sort of what had been assembled and try and find a thread in it. And that was really challenging. Like, we did. There was a story there. It was a great story about a personal relationship, these two people who'd met from different points on the globe and come together and fallen in love, and they'd created this amazing life together. But I don't enjoy that. Like, I really don't enjoy that. And as a director, I'm actually really interested in efficiency. Like, I'm interested in emotional efficiency, which means getting rid of the stuff that's in the way of actually what we're trying to say here. So the idea of spending time with so much footage is not all that appealing. Although I mean, you know, never say never. It would depend on if there was something that just caught my attention and I absolutely had to follow it. Yeah. I have made a small documentary about my dad. He's a photographer and he's married to film as opposed to digital. We have hours-long conversations about that, but it's still in editing. We shot it 2 years ago and it's still in editing.
So, wouldn't be if it was digital.
No. So that was my attempt at doc making. Hi.
Do you have anything in mind for your next project?
I've got 4 stories lined up, and they get progressively bigger technically, so I think it's a pretty reasonable path to try and follow. What I would like to do now is find a producing partner and find a writer for the story that I've got a really in-depth synopsis for. They're not Aboriginal material, but I would sure be open to that again if something came my way. And I also know that it's going to take a while to develop these, so I'm expecting that things will come in between now and those projects to keep me busy in the meantime. Yeah.
I don't know if this has been covered. What was the germ of the story to begin with, and was there a eureka moment when you said, aha, this is what I'm going to do the next film on, and that you knew which way to go at that point, or did it slowly evolve?
Me realizing that this was the script that I wanted to make?
When you get an idea for a story, there's a eureka moment.
Yeah.
Sometimes, is there one in this case? Where you said, aha, this film's going to be about two
Indians. Well, I didn't write it. I didn't write it.
I'm curious about whether you knew the genesis, the Big Bang moment.
The writer is a man named Andrew Janelle, and he lives out in Hope on Stolo Land, First Nations writer, and he's prolific. He churns out scripts like the rest of us breathe and eat and sleep. He just writes and writes and writes. And what I've learned about him is if he gets a whiff that you're looking for material, he'll just start sending you things. Like, he'll just start sending you stuff, which is what he did with me. We hadn't even met in person. He heard through a mutual friend that I was looking for material, so I just started getting emails with scripts in them. And it was wonderful. It was like, you know, Christmas. They were great. A lot of them were really good stories. And what I recognized in this one in particular is that it was very well crafted. I mean, it was just a much stronger script structurally than the other stuff that I was reading. So it was ready to go. And I also recognized that it was the right scope for a first feature. Like, it, you know, 2 characters in 1 space for 90 minutes, so that has its own challenges, but because my main access point is the performances and the story, I felt confident that I could pull that off, and there's not a lot of exterior shots or technical stuff or, you know, crane shots or car chases or that kind of thing. So I just recognized that it was a really good story and that I could do it, I could make it happen.
I think maybe we should wrap it up, but I'd just like to say... Oh, sorry. Yeah,
hi.
Go ahead.
I was just wondering, are you going to be taking me to any other film festivals?
Well, I have to be invited to film festivals. I've submitted it to other film festivals, absolutely. The fun thing is we're starting to get requests from Aboriginal film festivals in particular. I think the word has been spreading pretty quickly. And we're also starting to get requested by colleges and universities that have Native Studies programs. A cool email that I got was from Sir Wilfrid Laurier University in Ontario. Somebody said,